welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
Guys, you know how much I love trains, and this is inside a train, outside a train, all over, bullets flying, things happening everywhere. But Hal, tell us all the, give us the bird's eye lowdown on this caper.
The bird's eye lowdown, is that an oxymoron?
That's not sure. From Fire Sign Theater. I'm stealing from it blindly.
Excellent. All right. Minute 85. I had him on the ropes. On the speeding Hydra train, a cannon-wielding Hydra soldier fires two blue energy bolts at Steve Rogers. Captain America leaps onto his ceiling winch, riding its rails toward the soldier. Another blast slams into his shield, but Steve powers through, delivering a massive kick and a shield strike that sends the soldier crashing down. In the adjacent train car, Bucky Barnes trades fire with a relentless Hydra soldier, ducking behind a crate as bullets fly. Steve, wielding the fallen soldier's cannon, blasts open the doors, separating him from Bucky. Dr. Arnim Zola, watching on a video screen, worries. Bucky's pistol clicks empty after two final shots. Steve, peering through the doorway, reads the situation and slaps a fresh magazine into his own gun. He tosses it to Bucky, their eyes meeting in a quick nod. Steve charges the Hydra soldier, attacking Bucky, shield raised, deflecting bullets as Bucky fires. Steve rams a weapons crate, forcing the soldier to dodge into Bucky's line of fire. One shot drops the enemy. "I had him on the ropes," Bucky says, catching his breath. "I know you did," Steve replies, a faint grin breaking through. Suddenly, the cannon-wielding soldier reappears, firing at them both. "Get down," Steve shouts as a blast tears a hole in the train's side. Zola's voice crackles through the monitor. "Fire again. Kill him. Now." Bucky grabs Steve's shield and fires at the soldier. But another cannon blast sends him tumbling out through the hole, clinging desperately to the train's side. Steve snatches his shield from the floor and hurls it, knocking the soldier back into the forward cabin. Ripping off his helmet, Steve leans out, shouting, "Bucky!"
Oh, high tension, high anxiety, high everything going on.
Anxiety indeed.
Yes, and a wonderful callback there with the "I had him on the ropes" from yes. from that alleyway outside the newsreel. Beautiful. I did the one little thing from a Joe Johnston standpoint, riding a ceiling winch, which is reminiscent of the Rocketeer flying the Spruce Goose model out the door of the Howard Hughes hangar. So
absolutely,
Johnstonism, I guess you could call it.
A Johnstonism, a sort of a nice, not a getaway mechanism in this case, but just a way to use the environment to move yourself along, get on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's a great catch.
It did work very well. Brian, this is one of those complete lack of color situations, except for the blue of the bolts and the red of Cap's shield.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell in the entire minute, it's very washed out.
There's an orange explosion, but it is. It's, I think that that sort of captures the claustrophobia of the train. Steve doesn't have a lot of room to work here, which is not to his advantage. It's close quarters fighting. And I think the darkness, the crampedness of all that, you know, is emphasized by the color palette here.
And I think the coolness of it, that, you know, literally that sort of cool color temperature also reminds us that this is, that this is an austere situation. And it doesn't directly connect to the idea that we're in the snowy alpine mountains, but it does just help the whole scene feel cold.
Yeah, physically cold, yeah.
And you're getting the whole idea of the Hydra element. There is nothing homey about Hydra. Hydra is very much a virus, and it's something that needs to be destroyed. It's cold, it's uncaring, it's mechanical, it's very remote from human existence.
Yeah, but everything's kind of a gunmetal blue, you know.
Even the bolts from the weapons, the brightest things are still blue. It's interesting you use the word virus, Jim, because of the crates that we see full of biological weapons.
Yeah.
About, you know, the 10, 12 second mark, soldier is, that Bucky is changing fire with is hiding behind those.
Yeah. It's, I mean, yeah, they're all munitions, and it says biologic Waffen is weapon, right? I mean, it's their
weapon like force.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. So like, you know, the Luftwaffe, so like combat type force. And I think I misspoke. It looks like it's actually Bucky who's hiding behind those crates briefly.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a cut where we see him from one angle, and then.
Would you say that is part of what's going to be going on the America bomber? I'm just trying to figure out what might be on where Zola's train is headed.
I would sure think so. I mean, if you're going to, you know, send this one big airplane, you know, kind of a one-shot airplane on a, you know, potentially one-way mission, or at least maybe a one-shot mission with not a ton of likelihood of returning, you're desperate. You're going to load it up with everything you've got. And I would.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If they had these, I'd certainly see him using them.
As I recall, and we'll find out when we get to toward the end of the movie, but what sort of weapon was that big flying wing, or is that big flying wing going to drop on all the cities? It's biological warfare, right? It's not Hydra Blue bolts. It's
yeah, I'm not sure, because those, I mean, we'll talk about it more when we get there, but all those individual, you know, the New York, Chicago ones that are all set up, I'm assuming that it's going to drop something. I don't think he has atomic power. Unless no. There's some kind of a, unless he's come up with some kind of a tesseract bomb that those, you know, right. Those are suicide bombers. But we'll talk about that more in the future.
Yeah. But I'm intrigued. I like the observation of the biological Waffen here, though, the Waffen. This train is packed full of. I never really thought about what the train was transporting, but I sort of always, my inner headcanon was, this is just all the good stuff. You know, this is this is vital materials that they need to move, because Captain America's destroyed all of the laboratories throughout Germany and Bavaria and wherever the labs are. They got to move this stuff.
Yeah. And remember the mission a couple episodes ago, the mission is to get Zola. They're trying this. The whole thing here is they're trying to cut out the brains of the organization, which, to, you know, the Howling Commandos, the SSR knows Zola's behind it. So if they can get him, that's the job here, not to stop this train, but capture and, you know, relieve him of his knowledge. So, but as we've been seeing in the montages, they're running out of labs to do stuff. So he's actually got to go all the way to where the America bomber is. Just interesting that they use trains. I guess that's going to be the best way to get it out of the area, rather than risking putting it on the roads where Cap can zoom in and hit a couple of trucks and get, you know, pick them off one by one. Although he seems to be doing it here.
Well, when you're the bad guy, I mean, really, you know, can you hide from Captain America?
No, no. There's some neat Bucky stuff in this minute. I was thrilled for the moment when Bucky wields the shield.
Yeah.
Yes.
It really is just a nice parallelism there of, you know, Steve Rogers, Captain America, but then Bucky, who is also has the spirit and the fighting spirit and the heart of Captain America as well. And as we know in the future, he becomes sort of this dark mirror image Captain America. So it's a neat bit of foreshadowing there, just to see Bucky hold the thing, this sacred Excalibur that he too is worthy to pick up, even though that's the wrong Marvel weapon.
Yeah, I mean, it might be more like Han Solo opening up that town with a lightsaber at the beginning of it. If you want to cross franchises, that
very much so. You know, we were there when that movie showed, and I remember just from that scene alone, people were speculating, well, Han Solo, he's going to be a Jedi because he picked up a lightsaber. You know, it's very very similar to that. I appreciate that. That's a good callback.
That's a great callback.
Yeah, it's impressive. Just imagine trying to film this scene, because you've got, you know, Panavision cameras and they're rolling through, all trying to, you know, trying to show this motion. But the very claustrophobic nature of the scene, you can only move the camera a little bit because there's a whole bunch of stuff behind you. This isn't filmed on an iPhone. This was back in 2011, so the gear was pretty big while they were filming it. I'm impressed just simply that they gave the impression to you that they were moving the camera down the length of the train car, but really, if you watch individual scenes, they're only moving the camera about maybe 3 or 4 feet back and forth.
And they're also, of course, giving the impression that there's that somewhere or somehow there's a full-size train with all the rolling stock in order and connected to each other and stuff. There's, never once are you seeing any sort of disconnect. Wait, are they in just a building or a room? Nope. This is, part of the train going from one car to the other. And we've got Zola's early closed circuit television monitor. He says, well, those great sort of sepia monitors, which are one of the only pseudo slightly warm things that we get in this minute. And it's interesting to me to think about whether when Zola's looking and he's seeing Captain America going through one of the train cars, did they just have enough footage when it was time to put these shots together, that was shot already to just say, here, this will be a good one to put on the camera, or we're going to cut to this view from the closed circuit camera. Knowing Joe, I can imagine him storyboarding even these little clips very carefully and
Oh,
saying, now we need the specific shots from the closed circuit cameras. And
I
of
bet they would
course,
have had to because the angle of that camera is not one that shows otherwise, and it's got a little fisheye to it. It's
right.
shot from above. It's like it looks like a security camera footage.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we don't really see a matching angle as they go back and forth. And then you imagine the fun that I don't mean that sarcastically, but the whether it's sort of the VFX phase, probably the editors had saying, okay, we've got this footage. Now, what would it look like on a rudimentary 1943 CRT? So let's do the color
And
cast and add the grain and make it some
it's
distortion and add some blur. It'd be easy to overdo it, frankly, but it'd be fun to just be the one tinkering with that.
and the Germans were like pioneers in television back during the 1936 Olympics. They had come up with a very rudimentary, it only had 180 line resolution, but they broadcast in Berlin, they broadcast the 1936 Summer Olympics for 8 hours a day. They were
Crazy.
broadcasting on this extremely low resolution on little screens that were maybe 8 or 9 inches tall. So just about roughly about the size of what Dr. Zola's looking at, that would have been in a couple of upper class Berlin households. They did improve to 441 lines by 1937, but it really didn't. They really didn't invest a lot in it during World War II. Of course, they had other things to do with cathode ray tubes and amplifiers. So, but just interesting to see how, this is pretty much what a German TV set would have looked like in the early 40s.
It's fascinating how many of the technologies we think of as being from the, late 40s, 50s, 60s actually were developed much earlier. I mean, one of the bits of trivia I picked up working on my book, Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow, is that the fax machine was invented in the 30s.
Well, actually, it came back from the 1847 was the first
Well,
type
that's
of
true. You
fax
could do
machine.
it with telegraphy, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So there was.
Because that's where you get that lovely fact about it being theoretically possible that a samurai could have sent a fax to Abraham Lincoln. And there's just enough crossover there. And speaking of that television, if you look closely, you see there's a plate under the screen, and I'm not entirely sure on the pronunciation, but something like Übervachung,
Oh,
which literally
like
just means. So
Overwatcher.
like I took the literal translation to mean Overwatch. Uber is over and things, and as a German word, it translates to monitoring, which has roughly the same connotation. So I was just was curious if that was being thought of as a brand, or it's just this is a label. This is what this thing is doing. This monitor you're looking at, it monitors things.
It monitors things.
Yes.
Well, that's lovely. I had a note on this minute. It's one we've discussed before, but I think it's a good one to bring up again. I think this minute really illustrates that whatever experiments Zola and the Red Skull were doing on Bucky, he's not a super soldier yet. And we discussed at what point Bucky became a super soldier. He's not one yet. He gets blasted by that blast and and knocked out the side port in a way that Steve Rogers would not have.
Yeah, that's a good point. As you know, we had that theory that okay, well, maybe he was held captive, and when Cap rescued him, he was in a bad way, and had they injected him with something there, but right now he's still, you know, he's just Bucky.
I think where we came to it before was he at this point maybe is a half baked super soldier.
Yeah, his Jell-O hadn't set yet. So
yeah, that's kind of what we came up with, and maybe the Russians gave him the Vita Rays or something like that to finish the job. But he seems like a very skilled and physically fit but ordinary guy in this scene.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's kind of made his peace with understanding Cap. That I think they're best buddies. Like he isn't weirded out by Captain America anymore, at least, you know, on this mission. We've seen him grow over time and saying, yeah, okay, this is the guy I knew, Steve. He's in a whole different situation now, but I can appreciate who he's become. Ever since the Let's Hear It for Captain America, I think that was kind of said sardonically a bit, but I think here they're definitely a team of, if not equals, then he can respect the strength of Captain America and rely on him.
Yeah, very much so. And as we spent quite a bit of time talking about the montage, that montage covered a lot of action. These guys have been through a lot together by this point.
Right. So, and those kinds of personal relationships get compressed and enhanced so much so when you're talking about life and death situations and high stress, things like that, everything develops just more aggressively and more quickly.
Yeah. And you know, we see some of this too in the unspoken teamwork between Cap and Bucky, where, you know, Cap tosses Bucky his loaded pistol and that kind of thing. They've done this before. They're working seamlessly and wordlessly together toward the common goal. They both understand what the other's doing.
Yeah. I can't help but notice how much the cannon wielding Hydra guy looks like one of the final scenes in Castle Wolfenstein. If you've ever, as many of us played many, many, many moons ago, he does look like the kind of a guy that you'd bump into while, you know, eating dog food and, you know, rubbing yourself with Red Cross emblems to get to retain your health.
What a great point. And that was, you know, when you talk about the gaming, the PC gaming in particular, a lot of people hold up Doom by id Software. Well, that was the first real first person shooter, but I will always tell you it was Wolfenstein 3D. That was such a game changer that, you know, you've played games like this before, but not from the point of view of the protagonist. And it looks clunky and crazy slow now, but back then it was mind blowing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So much office equipment was used wrongly to set up networks so you could
yes,
you know, it's after five, we could do this, and just getting people to load it. And even the shape of this of the tunnels, the doorways and things, just hit me as, yeah, this is Wolfenstein. I can just
slightly higher resolution in this film.
Yeah, true
versus the but you know, presumably 640 by 480, 16 color.
Just as blue gray as the walls were in the original. Yes. So,
You know, I'm looking at this guy with the two cannons on his arms, and it's interesting that we don't really get a good look at him. He's just this hulking, threatening silhouette that has a little blue glow crackling around him. But I was trying to examine his costume and see if it's the traditional Hydra garb, which in the movie is very much what they wear in the comics, especially the goggle helmet look. And this guy, you don't really get a good look at him, and I think it adds to his menace.
Yeah, he's got all kinds of there's like that plate. Oh, when they first went into the Hydra headquarters to rescue Bucky in the first place, we noticed that there was a helmet and then like an over helmet. There was like a liner and then a helmet, and it looks like he's wearing the liner and the helmet at the same time. Just when he's getting hit in the head with those suitcases, you can see the helmet as almost as part of the goggles. Like the goggles seem to be built into it. And he does have red, what looks like red sleeves, I think. It's, oh no, that's the red Hydra. That's the red Hydra logo, much like Red Skull was wearing.
Oh right.
So maybe these are the Extreme Elite. You know, the Droidicars of the. Sorry, not yes. Droidicars, but yeah, they seem to be the higher ups.
You get the red badge.
Yeah, yes. You're special.
I had one more note on this minute, and that is toward the end, Steve rips the helmet off his head and goes to rescue Bucky. From a war fighting perspective, that's probably not smart to take away your head protection. But from a movie making perspective, it always amuses me as a fan of the comics how often superheroes take their masks off in Marvel movies. Because we want to see the stars. You want to see Chris Evans. You want to see, you know, Tobey Maguire or, you know, and particularly Spider-Man, because he's got that red full face mask. And you don't know that the actor's under there unless he rips it off.
Right.
But you know, Steve does the same thing here. And the only reason Captain America would take his helmet off there is because the movie makers want us to see what Steve Rod or that what Chris Evans looks like.
Yeah,
exactly. And it does give him a nice bit of business to, you know, instead of sort of leaning forward and yelling Bucky, that, you know, that grandiose movement of the hand, you know, gives him something to do and kind of kicks off his whole movement through the scene.
Yeah. The thing the last few frames as we're seeing seeing poor Bucky hanging on for dear life on that railing, and the train cars further in the back. Oh, I keep thinking of what beautiful cars they are, and I had asked Joe about those cars. I said, were they real or were they CGI? And he said, well, they're obviously CGI, because if they were real, I'd own them. So he would have, knowing Joe's affection for Railroadania.
I'm sure imagine. ILM still has the files, and they could share them with Joe, and he could, when he gets into 3D printing,
print them up.
Print them up. Yeah. No, I think it would be beautiful. Beautiful. I love that, that arched viaduct that the railroad is rolling over. And it's just so much detail, you know, the icicles hanging off the side, and it's only in maybe five frames, but they actually bothered to put a watery overflow that would ice up, and it's just gorgeous, that attention to detail in the background just for frames. They could have easily made it blurry, not bothered, but it's such an astonishing attention to detail that makes this movie even better when you slow it down.
It is beautiful, and it also immediately establishes the jeopardy Bucky's in. He's not going to fall 20 feet, he's going to fall 2,000 feet.
Yeah, that's a long way to the bottom. Might not be realistic, but who cares? It's the right way to do a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been another fantastic moment in history. We're gonna have some hard times coming up in the next minute or two, so stay tuned for that. But if you would like to continue the conversation, we are always available at Camp Lehigh Captain America Minute Listeners Base over on Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, you could try checking out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. Be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.